Good morning. I'd like to call the June 28th, 2018 meeting of the Delta Stewardship Council to order. We are in a little bit different room due to construction in the building. We are, if anybody's following along and planning to come, we're on the third floor of the Park Tower building and not the second floor conference room where we normally find ourselves. Wrigley Field in Chicago is often referred to as the friendly confines because of its small nature. So we're going to have to refer to this conference room, this meeting room, as the friendly confines. But there are plenty of empty seats if anybody is planning to come and join us. Let's establish a quorum, beginning with Council Member Damrell.
Damrell
here.
Weinberg here.
Gatto here.
Fiorina here.
Tatayan here.
We have a quorum. First item is to recess to closed executive session. For those of you that are following along, it's likely that that will last 45 minutes. So I would recommend tuning in about 9:45. It could run longer, but that's the target time that we'll shoot for. So we are now in closed executive session. Thank you. Okay, we are online. Call the meeting back to order. Nothing to report from closed executive session. As an administrative matter, for those of you that are new to the third floor, the restroom is located in the northeast corner of this floor. It requires a key, and Lita, who is not currently at the desk.
It's on the wall.
Okay. The key to the restroom is on the wall in the back for anybody that needs that. Okay. Next item, file item 5, adoption of the May 24th, 2018 meeting summary. There are a couple of revisions to correct the record, and those have been passed out. So, and for those of you that are here, there is a revised copy on the table, should you care to grab that. What's the council's pleasure? Tatayan moves and Gatto seconds. Any discussion on approval of the math meeting summary? All right, then let's proceed with the vote, beginning with Council Member Damrell. Fiorini, aye.
Tatayan, aye.
Motion passes. Next item, Chair's report. I believe Ken Weinberg had a report he wanted to make on a presentation, and we anticipate he will be here soon. Some of you were on a tour of the Delta yesterday. This would be a good opportunity to share observations and anything regarding that tour, if you would like. Microphone.
The tour was, I've done several of these. This was, I thought, the most instructive. And Michael George deserves a great deal of credit. We basically saw, I saw much of the same thing I saw before, but enhanced by his knowledge and his observations. It was a very informative. By the way, I note this on our agenda, but we did observe a number of submerged, abandoned vessels in the Delta, and I think it certainly would add a little additional arguments, if you needed any, to Mr. Frazier's bill. But it was really, really very instructive and very informative, and I'd really like to thank Michael George. He was remarkably well-informed and just was a constant teaching. So, and plus the fish biologist, which he was excellent as well. So we had, it was a great tour.
Mm-hmm. Great. Maria?
Yeah, same. I think the one of the strength of the tour was that it was both from land and water, and we could hear so much about what's going on there and how much and the details on the water side. So mm-hmm. It's good.
Ken, while you were out, I mentioned that you had made a presentation in Southern California that I thought you wanted to share about, and then also any observations from the tour yesterday.
No, just have to echo Maria and the judge. It was just really, and it was the second time I've been out on the water, and it made a lot more sense, you know, and I just was really impressed with just, we didn't see everything, but we were almost everywhere, mm-hmm. and it really gave us a sense of a lot of it, learned a lot, especially about ag within the Delta, and just a lot of talk about salmon. I gave a presentation to the Fallbrook Public Utilities District in northern San Diego County. They're a sort of a half agricultural and half municipal and industrial water agency, and just general on the council and the Delta plant, and got some interesting questions.
Okay. Anything else anyone would like to report in this last month? All right. Very good. Then we'll move on to file item number 7, the executive officer's report. Jessica Pearson.
Thank you. We sent a number of letters related to Delta plan implementation and coordination this month. There are copies of all these letters on our website. On May 30th, we sent 9 letters to congratulate project proponents on successful awards under DWR's Delta Levy Special Project 2016 grant solicitation, with the intention of making those project proponents aware of the Delta Plan, its requirements, and, of course, our offer to consult with them to ensure Delta Plan consistency. On June 14th, council staff submitted comments on the San Joaquin Council of Governments 2018-2040 Regional Transportation Plan and Sustainable Community Strategy, also with the intention of coordinating for consistency with the Delta Plan and its elements. We also sent a letter response this week, signed by myself and Dr. Calloway, responding to some concerns raised by Mr. Patrick Lewis regarding the scope and content of the drought synthesis report that was previewed at the council's March meeting. And understand we might hear more about that later. I'm happy to announce that one of the projects that we funded has reached a milestone. As part of the Council's work to enhance the Delta as a place and implement some of our Delta Plan Chapter 5 recommendations, the Council funded the Delta Conservancy to hold a public process to develop a Delta sign plan, of which there are copies on the table. The plan has been finalized, and it will be presented at the Conservancy's July board meeting. The Delta Protection Commission was also a partner in the project. The Delta Sign Plan is a Delta community-driven effort that resulted in consistent sign design templates for the Delta and identified the best locations for signs. The type of signs developed include welcome signs, wayfinding signs, place markers, and interpretive signs. The plan is considered a guide for signs in the Delta. It's not a directive. And the development of the plan and its designs was the result of 5 public meetings, direct outreach to Delta organizations, the Delta counties, and Caltrans. Next, the Conservancy is going to provide some grant funding to the Protection Commission to manufacture and place a number of the welcome and wayfinding signs throughout the Delta. The Conservancy and the Protection Commission are also working to identify additional funding and to assist interested parties in placing signs consistent with the signage plan. So if you would like to access the plan, it's available at www.visitcadelta.com/signs. We have a couple of new hires at the Council. Rachel Klopfenstein, I don't know if Rachel's in the audience, a little wave. She joined the Collaborative Science and Peer Review Unit of the Delta Science Program as an environmental scientist. She's originally from Shingle Springs and received her BS in Environmental Science and Management from UC Davis. As a student, she interned with the Center for Watershed Sciences and Stillwater Sciences. She received her MS in Marine Resource Management from Oregon State University. Her thesis focused on assessing the impacts of an invasive wetland plant on juvenile Chinook salmon in a restored wetland in the Columbia River estuary. Rachel comes to us from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Invasive Species Program, so welcome to Rachel. Brandon Chapin has joined the Council as the new manager of meeting services. Brandon is in the back. And special projects, where he will oversee coordination of our monthly Council meetings and focus on improving our stakeholder engagement program. He comes to us from the Conservancy, sorry Campbell, where he was the economic development lead working on marketing efforts for the Delta, including the Delta Sign Plan. He was also the Conservancy's board liaison. Prior to that, Brandon worked for the Department of Toxic Substances and the Energy Commission. He has a master's in public policy from Sac State and a BA in political science from Humboldt. So welcome to Brandon. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to our legal counsel, Andrew Torianen, for the legal update.
Andrew, before you begin, for those of you that are standing in the back, there are 3 seats available in the front row.
Thank you, council members. Just a very brief legal update this month that Rebecca Mills, our legal intern, will handle.
Good morning, Council. Chair Fiorini. The DWR validation action has been coordinated now with the CEQA and the California Endangered Species Act cases. The parties are still arguing about how the court should hear these coordinated claims and in what order. The parties opposing the validation action all want the court to hear the CEQA and CESA claims first. They argue that validation of the Waterfix bonds might prejudice further consideration of CEQA and CESA claims. DWR argues that the validation action presents only the narrow issue of whether the project financing is valid, and thus the validation action should not address other issues such as the affirmative defenses regarding CEQA, CESA, the Delta Reform Act, and area of origin water laws. The opposing parties argue that the validity of the project financing, however, is dependent on DWR's compliance with these laws. The parties recently held a case management conference in which the court directed the parties to try to resolve their disputes regarding the scope of the validation record, and another case management conference is scheduled for July 26th. That conference will focus on the order in which the court will hear the CEQA and CISA claims. And the DSC legal staff will continue to monitor these lawsuits and report as necessary, in particular regarding the scope of any Delta Reform Act issues that are raised by the parties. On June 7th in the Eastern District Federal Court, Judge Lawrence O'Neill vacated the final environmental impact documents and biological opinion relied on by San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority and the Bureau of Reclamation in 2015 to approve the 10-year water transfer program. The project's purpose was to facilitate water transfers from sellers upstream of the Delta to users south of the Delta when sales use the infrastructure of the Central Valley Water Project or the State Water Project. As a means to address severe reduction in CVP water supplies and allocations that occur during those dry years. The project water transfers would have primarily been made through groundwater substitution, cropland idling, and crop shifting. Judge O'Neill previously found that the final environmental impact documents and the BIOP were unlawful following consideration of the parties' cross motions for summary judgment. And in that order, the court found that the final environmental impact documents failed to reconcile its findings on climate change impacts under NEPA, to integrate existing Delta water quality conditions as required by CEQA, and the court further found the documents deficient in its treatment of groundwater as it relates to the mitigation, monitoring, and third-party impacts. And finally, the court found that the BIOP was deficient under the Endangered Species Act, as it failed to explain how the conservation measures adopted would avoid jeopardy of the giant garter snake. And that's all I have for you today.
Great. Any questions?
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Next, I'd like to invite up our legislative and policy advisor, Ryan Stambraugh, for our legislative update.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. As noted in my report last month, May 25th marked the deadline by which fiscal bills had to pass out of their respective appropriations committees. As a result, Assemblymember Quirk's AB 2053 that would have established a harmful algal bloom task force and which the council took a support in concept position on in April unfortunately failed to move forward. However, AB 2348 by Assemblymember Aguiar Curry, which the council also endorsed, related to winter flooding of rice fields, did progress and was heard in its first policy committee in the Senate earlier this week, where council staff testified on behalf of the measure. One additional note in regards to AB 2348 is that included in the budget the governor signed yesterday is $5 million to specifically incentivize the winter flooding of rice fields for environmental benefits. Continuing on that budget-related note, yesterday the governor also signed SB 854. This was the Natural Resources Trailer Bill. As the council will recall, this trailer bill revises elements of the Delta Levy Subventions Program related to the cost share sunset, the per mile deductible, and the ability to pay concept as well. It's worth noting that these revisions to the program are well aligned with the council's recommendations that were developed through the levy's investment strategy. Moving on to news from Capitol Hill, where earlier this week the Senate passed the Energy and Water Appropriations Bill, which included, among other things, nearly $200 million for California and Western drought programs. These funds are largely aimed at diversifying supply and overall system resiliency by augmenting storage, recycling, and desalination activities. Additionally, the bill includes $35 million to further fund restoration on the San Joaquin River, as well as a requirement that an independent risk analysis on Oroville Dam be conducted and its findings reported to Congress. And then finally this morning, I'd like to present for council consideration Assembly Bill 2441 by Assemblymember Jim Frazier, pertaining to abandoned vessel cleanup in the Delta. As the council is aware, abandoned vessels have plagued the Delta for a number of years and continue to pose a safety risk for swimmers, fishermen, and other boaters, as well as an environmental hazards for rivers and sloughs due to contamination caused by fuel, oil, and other debris. A recent study sponsored by the Department or by the Delta Protection Commission and Fish and Wildlife's Office of Spill Prevention and Response found that the Delta contains roughly 240 abandoned and derelict vessels at an estimated removal cost of over $33 million. AB 2441 seeks to address this issue by redirecting rental income from surface uses in the Delta, such as drilling rights, for the purposes of cleaning up abandoned vessels. According to an Assembly Appropriations analysis, this redirection of earmarked funds would provide roughly $7 million annually. While the Delta Plan does not currently include specific recommendations regarding abandoned vessels, there are a number of recommendations that speak broadly to the importance of protecting and enhancing the Delta's place characteristics impacted by this issue. Additionally, two of the five core strategies in the Delta as an evolving place chapter of the Delta Plan speak to encouraging recreation that allows visitors to appreciate the Delta and notes the importance of sustaining a vital local economy through things like tourism and recreation. AB 2441, which passed out of Senate Natural Resources and Water earlier this week with unanimous bipartisan support, currently enjoys no opposition and support from a broad array of interests, including the boards of supervisors for the counties of Contra Costa, Solano, and Yolo, recreation organizations, and the Delta Protection Commission. Should the council wish to entertain taking a position on this measure today, the staff recommendation would be a position of support. Happy to answer any questions the council may have.
Ryan, thank you for that. And if I could add just a little bit more to this, the abandoned vessel issue has been something the council has been concerned about for some time. Through our brown bag series, we use those and through the science program to highlight issues that we want to try and create dialogue or create greater awareness. On September 17th, Annie Daly, who's a graduate student working in the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Office of Spill Prevention, provided a brown bag and did an excellent job with pictures and with statistics highlighting how this is a significant issue in the Delta. That brown bag was well attended. There were members of the public, members of water agencies from environmental groups. Good discussion ensued, and I've got to think that brown bag was instrumental in encouraging the assembly member and others to sponsor such legislation. So I'm in speaking in favor of the staff recommendation. This is an action item if you choose to take an action. Questions?
Yes. Skip. A couple comments. First off, I think we should acknowledge that our chair was instrumental in working out the compromise on 854, so I wanted to thank you for that effort. That's what I'm being told, Randy, so take the credit, okay? But we don't see this often. On the issue of the Assembly Members 2441, I think this is what we all, as those that represent the Delta, those that are working to improve the Delta, this is the kind of bill that we should really get behind. And I'm hoping that our council is going to support it. And I'd like to make the offer to support the legislation when the time's appropriate.
Yes, I'm in concurrence, just because yesterday, the tour that we took, you can really see the negative impact of those vessels abandoned there. Okay. For the health of the people, the Delta, everybody, so I would support it.
Great. So we have a motion and a second. Any further questions before I take public comment? None. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to comment on this matter? If not, then I think we're ready for a vote.
Campbell, aye. Weinberg, aye.
Gatto, aye.
Marani, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Tatai, aye.
Motion passes unanimously. So, Ryan, we'll expect reports monthly on the progress of this. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ryan. And next, for item C, I'd like to invite up Carl Wilcox, the policy advisor to the director at the Department of Fish and Wildlife for the Delta. And he asked to appear before us to provide a status update on a Frank's Tract feasibility study. So welcome, Carl.
Thank you, Chairman Fiorini, council members. I just want to give you a brief summary of what's in the report. I had hoped that you would have the full report in front of you. Evidently, you don't. So we'll make an effort to provide those. We didn't print very many because they're expensive and we didn't have much money. But you have the executive summary, which provides a good overview of the report. And the report's also on the department's website. And you can make sure that you have it. There are some interesting animations there of the salinity effects of restoration and Frank's Tract that I think are very informative. So the feasibility study is the result of, it's an element of the Delta Smelt Resiliency Strategy that was put out by the Resources Agency in 2016, looking at actions that could be pursued to enhance habitat conditions for Delta Smelt specifically, and in so doing benefits a lot of other native species as well as pelagic species, things like striped bass in particular, by converting what Frank's Tract, which is dominated by submerged aquatic vegetation and is relatively shallow, into intertidal habitat and subsequently more deep open water habitat that would be deep enough to prevent submerged aquatic vegetation from establishing. The study focused on an alternative that was developed through a charrette process with hydrologists and biologists, and focused really on could you do something that would enhance the biological characteristics and productivity, and particularly for native fishes. The approach evaluated didn't consider kind of broader issues relative to navigation and those kinds of things. So it really started out as just a look at what you could do from a biological perspective. The focuses were on improving habitat conditions, specifically for Delta smelt, but more generally pelagic species and natives, improve food web support, increase turbidity or modify turbidity, which is an aspect of smelt habitat in particular that's beneficial for them, reduce predation. In being dominated by submerged aquatic vegetation, it's very good habitat for many of the non-native predators that occur in the Delta, and so, you know, modifying that characteristic changes the habitat, improves, shifts or reduces predator pressure potentially. And then also reduce entrainment of Delta smelt into the South and Central Delta, which is Frank's Tract is a mechanism for that transport, particularly in relationship to water operations. The study applied the guidance provided in a Delta Renewed, which was prepared or released by the San Francisco Estuary Institute in 2016, which provided guidance on restoration actions that should be pursued to correct some of the changes that have occurred over time through reclamation in the Delta. And one of the key elements is the fact that the Delta is a much more interconnected place than it was historically. Frank's Tract was part of a large island that included Bradford Island, Webb Tract, Frank's Tract, Little Frank's Tract, Bethel Island, and False River is called False River because it didn't go anywhere back in the day. Subsequently, it's been interconnected, and there's extreme connectivity through that area. So one of the things that the initial conceptual plan looked at was constraining that connectivity, and that brings a whole set of issues along with it separately. The study included both not only a biological component, but also a hydrodynamic modeling component that was done by the Department of Water Resources using 3D modeling and particle tracking to look at entrainment. And, you know, it was the same modeling tools that were used for the emergency drought barrier. And kind of coming out of that, what we saw was that you realized on a regular basis the benefits of the emergency salt barrier that was put in 2015. So by doing restoration there, you can potentially reduce the effects of salinity intrusion into the central and south delta. The modeling also indicated that there were some changes in flow velocities as a result of that. With the emergency drought barrier, there were significant velocity changes in fishermen's cut that were a significant issue locally. While there are some increases, they're not of the scale that occurred with the drought barrier because the restoration is to the east and the changes are somewhat different, but there are changes there as well as in Old River between the San Joaquin River and Frank's Track. Also, an engineering feasibility study was conducted by Moffitt and Nickel engineers. Basically, they found that it's feasible to construct a restoration there. It's expensive. But it is doable. There have been a number of studies done in the past, particularly in the early 2000s, as part of CalFed that looked at approaches to addressing entrainment and water quality issues associated with Frank's Track. They didn't look at restoration particularly, but focused primarily on a gate system and those kinds of things to improve water quality. The focus wasn't on habitat restoration. But you can achieve, certainly water quality benefits with the restoration. The study also assessed compatibility or consistency with state parks management plan for this Frank's Track state recreation area. Frank's Track is owned by Department of Parks and Recreation and is a part of the state park system. Management is very limited given parks' budget constraints. So there's not a lot that goes on out there. They do have a management plan that made recommendations about recreational improvements. It dates back to the late 80s. And it did include habitat restoration components that aren't necessarily that dissimilar from what was initially evaluated in the concept plan that was put together and is in the report. And we did work closely with state park staff in doing that analysis. As part of the study, we also worked with UC Davis, Brett Milligan, and his graduate student, Aleo Krauss-Pope, who've done a lot of kind of sociological work relative to restoration and the Delta and how it affects local communities and community perspectives. And they handled a lot of the public outreach. We did engage with hunting, fishing communities, and particularly the Bethel Island community, and I think highlighted in the report in Chapter 6 the issues that are associated with doing restoration work and changing Frank's Tract, particularly as it relates to the local economy that's related to navigation. Frank's Tract, to a great degree, is a highway that people in Bethel Island, the bass tournaments that come out of Bethel Island, use to get to other places in the Delta really quickly because of the speed constraints in Piper Slough along. Piper Slough is a long, sinuous channel. It fronts on residences, boat docks, all those kinds of things. So it has a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit. So people are looking to get through breaches in the Frank's Tract levee and into Frank's Tract and off quickly, and particularly as it relates to bass tournaments, which are a major component of the local economy. And I think there are upwards of 135 tournaments a year there. So it's a big deal, and as we move forward, assuming we move forward with additional planning, that would be a major component of that effort, particularly engaging the local community in the development of a plan. So next steps, the department's looking at potential funding sources to take a next step and look at a more detailed plan, and putting that together, and again working with state parks in particular, but the broader community, to assess how you could come up with a plan that meets the biological and ecosystem process objectives, but also maintains and enhances the interests of a local community. And I think there is something that could be done there. You know, Frank's Tract is, well, I guess I'll put it this way. You know, if you want to do things to restore the Delta, we need to do some things that are not just kind of tinkering around the edges, at least from my perspective, not necessarily the department, but from my perspective, you know, we go to the places that are pretty easy, where the elevations are right, where we can, and those are all at the edges, and we're not really changing the character and restoring some of the components of the historic Delta. And I think that's what's highlighted in a Delta Renewed, and, you know, to really change kind of the ecological character of the Delta, those are the kinds of things that need to be considered moving forward. So with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I think Councilmember Damrell has a question.
Well, I more of a comment, because we went right by Frank's Tract on our little tour with Michael George, and it's a stunning open water right in the middle of the Delta, and we took the deeper channel right along the edge of the Frank's Tract down the old river to the Clifton Forbay. But the point is that we were discussing, I'm sure that Ken and Maria were also in this conversation. Michael George was telling us about this, the potential restoration of Frank's Tract. And at the time, he said, I don't know where this is going to go. It's quite expensive, but it would be remarkable restoration, because it would really impact the Delta itself in the heart of the Delta. And so I became rather, I think we all were pretty enthused by the prospects of something happening. But no, it's very expensive, but it is a magnificent area. And when he described it, of deepening the channel, and then the shelf of marshland, it was just a beautiful concept. I can tell you that from my perspective, I thought, boy, this would be something to do. It would be very ecologically be marvelous. So I'm going to say some more things about it, but I'm going to yield to other members who were on the trip with me that probably heard the same conversation, but great idea.
Other comments, questions?
Yes, I agree with the judge, but I have a question in a sense that is there a list of similar, or is there a matrix, or is there some kind of a formula by which we pick and choose what could be restored, and when is the timing for that, if any? I just have this question unrelated to the matter here.
I don't think there isn't a matrix per se. I think there's a structured decision-making process that's currently underway, spearheaded by the Delta Science Program, doing it for the Bureau of Reclamation, looking at management actions within the Delta and evaluating those as to potential benefits. It was also being looked at as through the collaborative science and adaptive management process, and their structured decision-making process. It wasn't considered there because the report hadn't been completed and there wasn't enough data to pursue it. But I think there are a couple forums for structured decision, using structured decision making that could potentially rank some of these things.
So if somebody else brings up that why are we not restoring some other island, there would be this whole adaptive management and decision structure,
structured decision.
So that would be the answer. I'm trying to explain to ourselves that, you know, how we...
So I think there's another effort underway called the Central Delta Corridors Project that's looking at about 40,000 acres of islands within the Central Delta, including Staten Island, the metropolitan islands, and Sherman and Twitchell Island, to look at how you would proceed with restoration. One of the things about Frank's Tract is that it breached back in the 30s, and so it wasn't reclaimed for that long, and so it's not deeply subsided like many of those islands, which are upwards of 25 feet below sea level.
So there are certain criteria.
It's much more amenable to trying to raise the elevation and changing that. And, you know, the idea of raising part of it and dredging the other part to deepen it, you know, comes from the, it's much cheaper to do it that way, as opposed to trying to bring material in from other, particularly upland sources. So that, it's a cost savings to do that, plus you get multiple benefits, potentially.
Thank you.
Skip.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Carl, since you're the face of state government sitting at that, just from the local government's perspective, I'm pleased to see that they're looking at already owned state lands, because the impact that the state or federal government has when they acquire property is the obvious, is it goes off the tax rolls. And during the downturn in the economy some 5, 6, 7 years ago, the PILT program, for those in the audience, payment in lieu of taxes, which is a backfill for local government, they quit sending the PILT monies to us. So we not only lost what could have been farmable land, but we also lose property taxes. But when you have these sorts of projects next to viable farmers farming, it tends to impact them as well. So, again, I just wanted to compliment the state that they're looking at already owned properties and trying to restore them and not taking new lands out of production. And then you made mention about the breaching of the levees back in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a little history lesson on that? Why was it done? And
well, it was a natural breach. So it breached in... I think the year before they repaired it, and then it breached again the following year, and they didn't repair it. And so it was the decision of the landowners to, as to whether or not they would repair the breaches, and the decision was not to. And a similar situation occurred with Little Frank's Tract.
And one last comment. You know, the state acquires properties, and then in your report, you talk about, however, resources to support continued management and enhancement of the area are limited. That's really the problem, is that the state acquires properties, and then they put no money into managing it, restoring it, and it sits there. And it becomes, you know, a problem, not only for the locals in the area, but many others, boaters, fishermen, and maybe big mouth bass is a great, maybe that's a good thing, but there are a lot of negative impacts. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Jessica?
Well, I just wanted to build on Councilmember Maranian's question that the Delta Plan in its current ecosystem chapter does identify high priority restoration areas in the Delta. Those are rather large areas, but we have recommendations within that to prioritize willing sellers and publicly owned lands, et cetera. There's also the Eco Restore initiative that is being implemented by the administration, and that has already identified a kind of a prioritized list of restoration activities that's funded primarily through State Water Project mitigation funding. And then we'll have the opportunity as we move in further into our Delta Plan ecosystem chapter amendment and set new performance measures to take another look at this very question that you've proposed.
So, Ken.
Just wanted to, you know, I think the judge covered it very well, kind of our reaction, and I was asking John a lot of questions, and I think one of the things we came away with yesterday was, first of all, there's not a lot of opportunities everywhere. They're going to be focused that what habitat exists right now just sort of naturally, I really got a sense of, hey, there's only 2 or 3% of the original wetlands left in the Delta, and there's just these little pockets. So, Carl, when I read the summary report, it seemed like reduction in salinity was a key benefit. And when I think back to, God, was it 64,000 acres of tidal wetlands and restoration in the BDCP, you know, was Frank's track part of that?
Not really.
No.
It just was an acreage number. And
okay.
I think, you know, we have our real fixation with the North Delta Arc, and for good reason. But I think similar kinds of things can be done on the San Joaquin side as well, with some effort, and there's some opportunity there. And Frank's Tract is an example of that, Dutch Slough. So, you know, I think, you know, while most of the focus has been on the, you know, Cache Slough area and into Sassoon, there are opportunities other places, and this explores that.
So maybe my questions for John is, as we look at the restoration activities, and I want to, you know, maybe suggest that we, since we're in the middle of the ecosystem amendment, that we really not look at what was in the original plan, because we're changing it however much we change it. But I think I want to, at least for me, want to keep a real open mind on how that occurs. So, John, you know, as we look at the different restoration activities and what we're trying to accomplish, whether it's, you know, setback levees or tidal wetlands or, you know, just, you know, how many of those activities is Carl talking about in Frank's Tract as a, you know, hey, we can do a lot of different things here and have it to see, gee, how effective it is? Because I'm going to go back, Mr. Chair, to the last DPIC meeting, where Jeff Mount came in, and there was a big discussion, and Carl was a part of that, of, gee, we need to implement something. And I think you hear a lot of sort of frustration that, when are we going to implement something? The other thing I got out of yesterday was also that there's all this data out there. It's not all intuitive. Some of it's counterintuitive, but it's like it's time to implement something so we understand that. So I'll be quiet now.
Well, so I think one thing to point out and to highlight is, as Carl mentioned, even though Frank's Tract is underwater and looks to be a real challenge to restore, it hasn't subsided as much as many of the other islands because it's been underwater and the organic matter that's there hasn't all oxidized and disappeared. So it is a real unusual opportunity, I think. And although it will be a challenge to move that much sediment, it definitely offers many benefits. I think, you know, as you saw, Ken, or as we all saw, what's left are tiny little remnants of marshes around the edges of the islands and on the edges of the creeks. There really are very few expansive marshes like there used to be across the large areas of the Delta. And so Frank's Tract could be an opportunity to build those elevations in a large area and create a significant area of tidal wetland in that central part of the Delta where it would provide a lot of value. It would reduce the impacts of invasive species because of invasive plants and predators, so it would have those benefits. So I think it's, you know, it highlights many of the large-scale benefits that could be achieved. the other islands around it that have subsided more are going to be more challenging, but there still are some opportunities to achieve that. So I agree with your point. We shouldn't be constrained by how we've thought in the past. We should look more broadly, and I think we are doing that. You know, we are really looking across the range, but there are constraints in each of the different regions that make for a challenge.
Endless constraints.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask Carl one more question. And Carl, the $315 million, rough math, that's like $300,000 an acre to restore. I have no concept on this kind of scale, you know, where this fits in with other restoration projects.
It's probably an order of magnitude greater.
So we're talking about usually it's like $30,000 an acre. Okay. So that makes it a challenge.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we looked at, you know, tweaking some things. You know, the price could probably get down into the low 200,000s, you know, by, you know, I think probably eliminating filling in Little Frank's Track. We did evaluate a locally proposed concept, both hydrodynamically and from an engineering perspective, and it was kind of closer to $200 million. So I think
to do it all.
So I would expect it someplace in the range of 200. You know, it's just kind of an expensive proposition.
And phasing wouldn't sort of be, you really have to.
It's problematic to do that. You know, to do it would take 4 to 6 years of continuous construction anyway, so breaking it up into parts is probably difficult. And since you would be operating from basically on site, you know, the economies of scale and the mobilization costs are really important just to get in there and kind of get what you're going to do done and then move on.
One last comment. I just want to agree with Supervisor Thompson on the management part of it after you construct it. That, you know, my experience that it's always been a big challenge, and you need endowment money. I mean, if the state's not going to do it and go off the general budget, you know, I've been a part of some, you know, restoration mitigation projects. You have to have, you know, an endowment to hand to the Conservancy or some other group that, you know, knows how to do this and it can manage it. So that's also part of the financial aspects of it, is making sure there's money to manage it. Thank you for
sure. John,
I just wanted to add one additional thing that Carl mentioned, but highlight how unusual it is, and that's even considering all the ecological challenge, there's many social challenges. And so I think it's unusual that this, as a feasibility study, they worked with the local community to really identify what some of the opportunities, what some of the things people don't want to give up are. So I think that's definitely something that's not done often, and something that, you know, if we're going to do restoration that the community is going to embrace, we need to think about that. And it's very valuable that they've done that.
And yeah. I just want to note that Alejo Krauss Polk was once an intern at the Delta Stewardship Council.
Yeah, just so everyone's aware, there's the feasibility report, and then there are a series of other reports that basically supported what's in the glossy version. So there's there are engineering reports, there's the hydrodynamic modeling report, and the report prepared by Brett Milligan and Alejo, and that really they have conducted a survey as part of this, and I think have had in excess of 750 responses, and widely, not just from the local community but the Bay Area, Central Valley, you know, so there's Frank's Track's a unique place, so stepping into it creates a lot of issues, and there are a lot of people that just leave it alone. So, but I think there are opportunities there that could benefit the local community in the long run and address the sustainability issues into the future. You know, one of the the fellows that lives out there, you know, has, you know, is very concerned about just the deterioration of Frank's Tract, or Little Frank's Tract, which he lives near, just because there's no maintenance. The levees are continuing to break down. They will continue into the future going that way. So I think, you know, there's a point at which you have to consider, okay, how do we account for what's going to happen in the future and take actions that create some sustainability about what's there now, because it's not going to stay that way forever.
So, Carl, a couple of quick questions. First of all, this is good that you're pursuing this. This has been a subject matter for a long time that many people have expressed concerns about. It seems to be a genuine agreement that something needs to be done, not an agreement on what that is. My two questions are, one, when you change the landscape to this level, it may influence wind currents. Has anybody studied the effects of wind and wave fetch? And does the $315 million include any enhancement to the downwind levees that already are being impacted by wave fetch from open water?
We did look at wind wave action. So by reducing the fetch, particularly for the westerlies, you do reduce wave height in the eastern portion of and depending, you know, I think if you look at the locally proposed alternative, it breaks things up even more. But a component would probably be certainly in what was proposed from the local side, buttressing some of the existing levees, particularly along Piper Slough, and creating them more as habitat levees as opposed to kind of their deteriorating condition.
Great. Any other questions of Carl? Good. Thanks.
Oh. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you, Carl.
Did you have a question? Sorry.
Okay. I wanted to add, I think we would be remiss if we didn't acknowledge that Michael George had us meet with Tom Slater on the banks of the river there, and really had a nice discussion. And he's on the board, I think, of North Delta Water Agency. It was just, you know, put a face to an issue, and we really did that, and had a very engaging conversation with him. And the same thing happened across the river from Clarksburg. In Cortland, we met with Green Hemley, the pear packing, a very large pear packing, multi-generational company, and sat down with them, the father and the daughter, who, by the way, I think she did speak of us. There was a magnificent home right on the river that's very noticeable in Cortland. Anyway, the only point I'm making is that Michael George did a great service to us by allowing us to sit down on the banks of the San Joaquin and talk about the problems that they face individually, separate problems, but very much problems. And I think that was very helpful to us to understand what they're facing.
Mr. A quick comment on the judge's comments. You know, this is, I always love to hear folks that don't go onto the Delta much, come back and talk about how beautiful it is, what the value is of the Delta. And so, so you may understand why some of us are passionate about trying to protect the Delta and make sure people, once they understand what the Delta is, I think it changes their perspective. And so I'm very happy to hear you talk more about the Delta and the interaction between some of the folks that live and work on the Delta and how difficult it is when you start making these wholesale changes. That could disrupt their lives, certainly, and maybe some of our legacy communities might go out of business. So keep talking, Judge. It's good music to my ears.
I was just going to say, in the interest of time, that concludes my executive officer's report.
Thank you, Jessica. Any requests for public comment on this matter, Lita? All right, then on to file item number 8, the lead scientist report, Dr. John Calloway.
Great. I'll just finish up with follow up on the field trip, because it really was super valuable. I think it's interesting to see we've already talked about abandoned vessels, we've already talked about Frank's Tract, We've already talked about False River, so actually Michael George said the same thing of False River. I think is called False River because it doesn't go anywhere, so it was good to hear Carl confirm that. And also we talked about invasive plants, or we saw a lot of invasive plants, and that's something I'm going to talk about. So it was super relevant and super valuable. So thanks again to Michael George and to the staff from Fish Bio who gave us the tour, and Jessica Law was able to attend as well. So it was very informative. Okay, so for my my report, I'm going to talk about one recent journal article and then give you an update on a few other items. So the journal article is entitled Increasing Precipitation Volatility in 21st Century California. The first author is Daniel Swain. Daniel Swain is a researcher at UCLA, and he also is the author of the California Weather Blog. That's a really informative and useful news source for current weather and climate issues. And his other colleagues are from the Nature Conservancy, UC Irvine, and also Alex Hall from UCLA. So I chose this article because it sort of follows up on what we talked about last month in talking about atmospheric rivers and the impacts of atmospheric rivers on precipitation dynamics in California. Also, I think it's a great example of a paper that is a challenging, it's a complex issues that they present, but they really thought about getting that information across. The article is pretty informative and understandable, even though it's complex. And then I just passed around to you this handout that Daniel Swain put together and posted at the California Water Blog as a summary of the paper, and that really, my summary will follow exactly what he put together, because he really has thought about getting complex information across in a easily understandable way. So what this paper is all about is understanding how precipitation might change into the future in California. And we all know that California has extremely volatile precipitation on an annual basis. So we've had a long-term drought followed by an extremely wet year, which he refers to as precipitation whiplash, the dramatic changes back and forth between dry and wet conditions. We have highly variable conditions even within a year with dry summers and then intense wet winters. And so what they are highlighting is that although overall average rainfall in the state may not change that much into the future, what's really likely to change is this increased variability in precipitation and what some of the impacts of that might be. So they did this by looking at climate change models into the future using a tool called ensemble modeling. So rather than looking at one scenario, they run the model thousands of times with a range of different conditions and see what the probability or what the likelihood of different outcomes are. Doing that, what they found was that over the next 50 to 100 years, we are going to have more extremely wet years, as like 2016, 2017. And as they highlight on the handout there, 3 to 4, maybe even 5 times as many, there's an increase of 3 to 4 times the number of extremely wet years that we're likely to have into the future. Years like 2016, 2017 are going to become more and more frequent. Dry years are also going to become more frequent, probably not as big of an increase into the dry years, maybe just two times an increase in those extremely dry years across the state. And they point out there's also differences in Northern California and Southern California, with bigger extremes likely to occur in Southern California. Those two things of more frequent very, very wet years and more frequent very, very dry years also mean that we're going to have more of these precipitation whiplash events. And so those are also likely to increase from 1.5 or 1.25 times to 2 times as frequent in Southern California. I think most importantly or most immediately what they also point out is that not just the year-to-year variation is going to increase, but we're also likely to have a shorter wet season as we move into the coming decades, and we're likely to have more really intense prolonged storm events. In thinking about prolonged storm events, they refer to the Great Flood of 1862 that probably many of you have seen picture or paintings or engravings of. There's a famous engraving of K Street, Sacramento, about 6 feet underwater, and people canoeing or boating down K Street during 1862. There was 40 days of flooding, 40 days of rain. The Central Valley was flooded for pretty much the entire valley, 20 to 30 miles across, and almost 200 miles up and down the state for more than a month. So what they tried to look at was, is that occurred once in 200 years. That was a once in 200 year sequence of events in the 1860s. We haven't had anything like that since. What they point out is, with these increased extremes, those kinds of events are more likely to occur. Up to 5 times an increase across the state in those sorts of events. So instead of a 1 in 200 year event, it could become a less than a 1 in 50 year event. So I'll just read one quote that Daniel Swain put in his summary online. He said that one thing that he and his colleagues that found that was particularly eyebrow raising was that under the current emissions trajectory, that this 1862 event is more likely than not to occur in the next 40 years. So in the next 40 years, it's more than a 50% chance we'll have an event like that across the state that could flood the state for an extended period, and that multiple occurrences between now and the end of the century are likely to occur. They predicted somewhere between 2 and 4 times in the next 80 to 100 years that we may have that sort of an event. So think we just aren't prepared at all. Think of the impacts that occurred in the 2016-2017 winter, and if we were to dramatically increase that, how big of an impact that would have. So so just to summarize, I think they showed, you know, these extremely, an increase in both extremely wet years, not as big of an increase in dry years, but still some increase, and then an increase both in these changes, wet to dry to wet years, or the whiplash events, as well as these intense events. In terms of impacts, they point out that the increase in droughts is obviously going to lead to increased water scarcity and challenges in managing water in those drought periods. Increased wetness will lead to increased flooding and stress on our infrastructure. And also the whiplashes may lead to greater mudslides and greater impacts even beyond just the direct water effect. So I think it's a powerful article and well done and well presented. So any questions?
John, just a comment, lest the public be concerned about another event like the 1860s. We've added, I don't know, probably 30 million acre feet of storage in the system since then that has helped us get through years like 97 that could have potentially placed the San Joaquin Valley into the same conditions as the 1860s.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, so then the other items I wanted to update you on, the first is the recent workshop on conceptual modeling around Operation Baseline. So I think all of you are familiar with Operation Baseline is the effort that actually Cliff Dom, who's here and will present in just a bit, the former lead scientist, initiated in order to evaluate and provide preliminary data before the upgrade to the regional sand treatment plant, and to try to so that we can understand what the impacts of the changes of the treatment plant might be, so that we could get some data in advance of that. And the regional sand treatment plant, to remind you, will have dramatic impacts on overall nitrogen inputs into the Sacramento River, probably about a 70% reduction in their overall nitrogen inputs, and then it'll also change. Instead of ammonia coming in, that will be coming in as nitrate, and so a shift in the forms of nitrogen. And so the question is, what kinds of an impact will that have on primary productivity? What kind of impacts will that have on the food web? So the conceptual model that the Operation Baseline team is putting together, in addition to the field work they're doing, is to identify how those changes will move through the ecosystem. And so, just as I was saying, how is it going to affect algae and plants? How's that going to affect food webs? And then eventually, how's that going to affect the beneficial uses of water in terms of water quality, in terms of water availability, in terms of recreation or other aspects of beneficial uses of water. So this workshop was to introduce the conceptual model to the community. The attendees came from a broad range of agencies, stakeholder groups, and the public, and then to brainstorm with that group to identify what some of the key uncertainties are, where should we be focusing our efforts as the plant is going to start to make some changes in the coming year, and the real impacts will start to be seen in the next 2 to 3 years. And so this was to identify where should we be focusing our efforts. Should we be looking just at nutrient issues? Should we be looking at primary productivity issues? Should we be looking at algae or vascular plants? Should we be looking at impacts in the food web? Where should we put our efforts? Where are the opportunities to identify potential impacts and the biggest uncertainties? And where spatially should we be focusing our effort? So from that, there was the initial discussion or the initial conclusions that came out of it was focusing on nutrient concentrations immediately would be of most benefit, but also focusing on phytoplankton rather than looking at vascular plant productivity is probably where to focus efforts. Also, the need to develop models so that we can look at how the nutrients will be moved through the ecosystem, as well as how the nutrients might change as they start to move through the ecosystem. And the workshop will be putting together, that there will be a synthesis coming out of the workshop that probably will be available in the next few months. And so when that's available, I'll summarize that and highlight that for you. Any questions on that?
Thanks, John. I'm really interested in this. I'm wondering, will there be a schematic of these elements of the conceptual model? I notice here on page 2 it says, the conceptual framework highlights mechanisms that link major management topics, consumptive water use, recreation, navigation, habitat, food web, to changes in nutrient concentration, phytoplankton production, aquatic vegetation, etc.
Yes. There is a schematic, okay. So I'd be happy. I'll forward that to you. In its simple form, it's pretty analogous to what I described. In its complex form, it's very complicated. There's about 15 different secondary impacts that are, but the links between all of these factors are identified there. Other questions? I'll highlight, I think this is a useful, so, you know, we've been talking about the science plan update, and the science plan really is looking at facilitating and coordinating science on a relatively broad, high level, but efforts like this are really useful in identifying immediate, more detailed concerns and priorities for moving science forward. And so I think getting the community together like this is really the way to identify those priorities. I'll also mention the collaborative and adaptive management team did something similar around Delta salmon just a week after this nutrient workshop, and did a similar prioritization of issues for Delta salmon research. And when their report is done, I'll highlight that for you as well. Okay, so the next issue is integrated modeling, to update you on integrated modeling. So as you know, the science program and the science community in the Delta has a strong interest in using models to synthesize information and make that information usable for management decisions. The idea of integrated modeling is not just doing physical modeling, hydrological modeling, isolated from biological modeling or from climate modeling, but trying to put together those models so that we can see how water flow will affect nutrient dynamics and how that might link to primary productivity and food webs. There, detailed models of those kinds of interactions don't exist, but if we had those, they would be potentially very useful for management. So the science program has put together an integrated modeling steering committee of modelers and model users across agencies from across the Delta to identify how we might go about doing that. In addition to that steering committee of local agency and stakeholder members, we just recently put out a request for proposals to provide additional information for the steering committee about how models currently are being used in the Delta, about what some of the challenges or impediments to integrating those models are, and how we might address those. So we just recently finished that call for proposals, and Tetra Tech, a local consulting firm, will be doing the work under that call for proposals to do those efforts, identify how we already are using models effectively, how we might build on that, and what some of the opportunities are moving forward. And they will just be starting their work in July, so we're having a kickoff meeting with them in early July to get their work underway, and they'll take about a year to do that synthesis of understanding current use of modeling in the Delta. Questions, Ken?
John, but you know, back to SAC Regional and the modeling, they must have done modeling, because to get their permit from the regional board for discharge, they would have, had they made some conclusions about, impacts or changes that we're going to validate or not validate in having the baseline and then, looking after, or we, refining what they did. So maybe that's because what are we expecting to happen, or what did they expect to happen in terms of, reducing the nutrient load, and what are we going to be specifically looking for as we compare, after the changeover to the baseline?
So they're going to be looking at initially the effects on primary productivity. So how those changes in nutrients.
But was there some assumptions on that in terms of how the plant was permitted?
So actually, that was before my time, so I can't say. But maybe.
Oh, we can drag Cliff up.
I don't know.
Cliff. Trying to figure out how to do that.
I don't know. I can't answer that.
Oh, okay.
Other questions?
No.
Okay. Okay, so I'll finish the last item then. Focuses on a panel discussion that the science program and actually the Independent Science Board supported, focusing on invasive weeds in the Delta and using remote sensing to monitor and evaluate the spread of invasive weeds in the Delta. So as you know, the Independent Science Board is doing a review of monitoring efforts in general throughout the Delta. So this panel was a part of that broader effort focusing on monitoring. The panel included Susan Ustin, a professor at UC Davis, Eddie Hard from the California State Parks Division of Boating and Waterways, Shruti Khanna from CDFW, Jeff Wingfield from the Port of Stockton, and Gina Darin from the Department of Water Resources. And the panel was asked to identify how remote sensing, so how satellite images or data collected from aerial flights are used currently to map vegetation and in particular aquatic vegetation and aquatic invasives in the Delta, and what might be done into the future to improve that. What they really highlighted was that there are many efforts currently underway, but there's a lack of coordination between those efforts. And there's not what they highlighted that really would be most useful is to have at least two overflights a year. Satellite images are useful, but at not too coarse of a resolution to really map the distributions on a fine scale. And so it has to be data collected from aerial flights. And they currently, so as they pointed out, with collecting images in the spring and the fall, they could identify growth across the growing season. And then most importantly, there's significant efforts underway to eradicate and control the weeds. Over $10 million a year is currently being spent to control weeds in the Delta, but it's difficult to evaluate the effectiveness of that. With images in the fall and spring, in the spring and fall, in areas where they're doing it local eradication and where they aren't, they would be able to evaluate how effective the eradication methods are. And so they made a strong case for that coordination. The science program is working with Boating and Waterways and CDFW and DWR to try to facilitate some of that. And we're hoping that by next year, we should be able to get to where we can pool funds across those groups and support more intensive and more regular collection of data to map invasives. So any questions on that, the panel, or their findings? Okay, so then I'll turn it over to Amanda so we can hear by the numbers.
Thanks, John. Good morning, Chair Fiorini and council members. Here are the numbers for this month. There we go. First, and very briefly, I'd like to point out that precipitation totals and percent averages, as well as reservoir storages, all remained fairly similar to last month, so nothing too different or new to report on there. What I'd like to focus more on this month is snowpack and also flow. First, snowpack is substantially below average for both the northern and central Sierra regions, as well as the state as a whole. And if we look back a few years, this really exhibits a direct result of this precipitation volatility or whiplash that John was just talking about a moment ago. In California, we rarely have an average year for rain and snow, but rather we're seeing a fairly rapid succession of these more extreme years. Now on to flow, which is below average in our two major rivers, as well as for average monthly delta exports. And notably low is the flow in the San Joaquin River, which is reflected in the slight increase in salinity in the past month. And while flows do appear to be low, all of these numbers are similar and actually even above the numbers for other recent dry years. Now on to page 2 of your handout, which I've retitled Species and Ecosystems, since we've been talking more about just fish recently. As you might recall, we wrapped up the Delta smelt numbers from the spring Kodiak trawl last month. So this month I have something a little different for you, and that is the tricolored blackbird statewide survey. Oops, excuse me. But before I get into some numbers, a little background on the tricolored blackbird. Historically, this bird bred in huge colonies, up to millions of birds, in the wetlands of the Central Valley. However, due largely to habitat alteration, as well as pesticide use and shooting, the number of birds has declined dramatically. And in fact, there was an observed decline of over 60% from 2008 to 2014, which you can see in this graph. At the end of 2015, the tricolored blackbird received protection as a candidate species under the California Endangered Species Act. And just this past April, it was officially protected as a threatened species. So you might be wondering, well, why is this blackbird so important? Well, not only is it a part of the Delta ecosystem, but kind of like the Delta smelt, it can also serve as an indicator species. And basically, what's going on with this bird could possibly give us some clues to the health of the Delta and other systems in California, because the bird is sensitive to changes in land use and also climate, since it depends on these freshwater wetland habitats for breeding and also for food. So the statewide survey occurs all over the state for a 3-day period in April with a large number of experienced volunteers, and this occurs every 3 years. In 2017, there were 177,656 birds counted in total, which was a 22% increase from the last survey in 2014. And approximately 16% of this total was counted in the counties in and around the Delta. And finally, just to note, while the 2017 survey does appear to show a small rebound in population, these results should be taken with caution, since only 1 year of data can't really show us population stability yet. And that's all I have for you. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Amanda, thank you. Questions of Amanda, Ken.
Yeah, Amanda, is this a critical habitat issue? Is that where this is going, designating critical habitat for the tricolored blackbird?
Yes, I believe that. So that's the main reason that their numbers have declined, I believe. So it would be a critical habitat issue. They breed in wetlands.
So does this have an effect on kind of restoration activities or what we try and accomplish in restoration, or is it all sort of work together? I mean, is this what do you want us to take if there's a, and it isn't necessarily, you don't have to answer this, but what should we take away from the fact that you've got another species telling us that there's not enough habitat, I'm guessing, to sustain it, and different issues than fish?
Well, I think here what's different from the Delta smelt is that this survey actually does show some increase in numbers. And this came after it was designated, at least as a candidate, under the California Endangered Species Act. So perhaps with protection, some of these species can show rebound in their populations. So I think it also shows hope as opposed to all negative.
But we don't know what to attribute. If this is a rebound, we don't know what to attribute.
Right,
to.
We don't know yet. You're okay. Absolutely right. We have to wait and see, kind of.
But we know habitat is the key driver in the drops in numbers.
I believe so, as well as people just being more aware of this bird and not shooting them or.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Hey, that's a good thing. No, thank you. Thank you for answering. I didn't want to put you on the spot, but you have great answers.
Amanda, I'm impressed that somebody could count 177,656 little birds.
What about in 2008?
Yeah. John, anything else?
No, I think as Amanda pointed out, definitely habitat loss is an issue. But that, so I think they're using primarily freshwater wetlands. So as we do more restoration of those wetlands, both tidal wetlands as well as wetlands. And farther up in the watershed, it should have some positive effects.
Reducing salinity in those wetlands and getting freshwater habitat. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. That concludes file item number 8. John, thank you. Yes. Amanda, thank you. I have one request for public comment from Tim O'Loughlin with O'Loughlin in Paris.
Just stepped out.
Tim just stepped out. Well, all right. Well, actually, what I was going to do, I'd like to work through the rest of the agenda and not break for lunch. We've probably got another hour to go. So I'd like to give you a five-minute break now, and then when we resume, we'll pick up on file item number 9 and the public comment if Tim's back. Okay, so we'll resume now with file item number 9. We have a pending request to address the council that we'll get to when we can. Jeff Henderson is going to introduce file item number 9, Delta Science Governance, Data to Decision Making.
Thank you, Chair Fiorini. Good morning, council members.
Is this on? It is. Good. So science governance, in particular, how policymakers get from data to decisions, is an area of increasing interest in the Delta. And council staff has been providing for the council an overview of a number of key components and decision-making methodologies at the council meetings between May and August of this year that we're referring to as the Data to Decision-Making series of panels. In May, the council heard a panel regarding data and the implementation of AB 1755, which is the Open and Transparent Data Act. This month's focus is on performance measures and how focusing on performance measures assists in how you translate sort of our broad programmatic goals into objectives and then measurable indicators of progress. In April 2018, the council did adopt a refined set of performance measures as part of the Delta Plan amendments processed in 2018 that helped to track data plan Delta Plan outputs and outcomes. The performance measures themselves are an important component of the council's adaptive management approach and a way that we use those measures to track progress in how well we're achieving the co-equal goals and how to measure effectiveness of the Delta Plan over time. And a lot of interest, it's essentially led to a lot of interest on the part of the council staff in understanding how potentially other agencies that also have large programs that are based on indicators, how they perform and how lessons learned from these agencies that are engaged in performance assessment, what are the challenges, what are the issues that they encounter, and how can we best prepare to encounter those same issues. Some of those issues include things like evaluating stable measures against shifting baselines, reconciling varying outcomes against a suite of measures, and maintaining consistent measures while also incorporating how to be responsive to changing conditions. And our panel members this morning will discuss these and other challenges, providing examples and lessons learned from performance measures implemented in other large aquatic ecosystems, including the Puget Sound in Washington State, the Kissimmee River in Florida, and the San Francisco Estuary. Our panel includes today Martina Kohler, who is our program manager for the Council's Performance Management Unit, Tracy Collier, a member of the Delta Independent Science Board, Cliff Dom, the former Delta lead scientist and an emeritus professor at the University of New Mexico, and Caitlin Sweeney, who is the executive director of the San Francisco Estuary Partnership. And I'll go ahead and hand it over to Martina.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning, council members. I would like to give a brief background about the Delta Plan performance measures, why we have them, what are they, and how do we report and track them. So why we have performance measures? The council is using the performance measures to track progress in meeting the co-equal goals and to measure effectiveness of the Delta Plan. The Delta Reform Act of 2009 requires that the Delta Plan includes performance measures to provide measurable assessments of the status and trends of the Delta health, as well as the reliability of the state water supply exported from the Sacramento and San Joaquin River watersheds. So the Delta Plan adopted in 2013 included an initial set of performance measures, and this initial set was then expanded and refined in February 2016. And even after that, the measurable performance measures continue to be revised and refined. This process included internal and external technical reviews and input from agency and stakeholders, internal and external science reviews including the Delta lead scientist, Delta science program, a letter from the Delta Science Independent Board, and also public workshop and public comment period, as well as input from council members during council meetings. Council adopted a revised set of performance measures a couple of months ago in April 2018. And the Appendix E to the Delta Plan contains all of the performance measures as of today. What are they? The Delta Plan has three types of performance measures: administrative, output, and outcome measures. The administrative measures are management actions by decision and policymakers, such as various plans, resource allocations, legislature, water quality objectives. Output measures are also known as drivers, and they are the on-the-ground implementations of management actions. So these are the impacts and effects of management actions on the system. And they also include natural phenomena, like uncontrollable factors that we cannot control. And then the outcome measures, these are the ones that are kind of like the responses to the on-the-ground implementation. So these are the effects and impacts of those actions. So these are usually those that are most interested in, and they are also hardest to measure. So maybe give an example from the Chapter 6, the water quality chapter. So in that one example for the administrative measure is setting water quality objectives for the nutrients in the delta. That's the administrative measure. The output measure would be concentration of ammonium, nitrate, and phosphorus in the delta waterways. And then the outcome measure could be reduced harmful algae blooms in delta waterways. Another example, as far as contaminants, for example, so administrative measure is the setting the total maximum daily loads for the contaminants. Output measure is the reduction in concentration of those contaminants in the waters. And then the outcome is measurable toxicity in sediment samples from those contaminants. It's approaching less than, it's approaching zero. So this is an example for these three types. How are we tracking them? How are we reporting on them? The council is already tracking the administrative measures using online dashboard. So for the output and outcome measures, we just initiated development of a kind of similar dashboard, but it would be focused on providing the output and outcome metrics, including like what are the targets and what are the baseline conditions that we are comparing to. So we would like the output-outcome dashboard would communicate the status of outcome and output and outcome measures and provide informative graphs and charts and maps. While we are kind of designing and planning this tool, we are looking at the other large ecosystems that have been using performance measures as far as like design ideas. So on the screen, you can see some ideas that are some options how they kind of use providing kind of the information about this this type of measurements. So I would like to kind of, in closing, the Delta Plan performance measures cover all the resource chapters of the Delta Plan. So not only the health of the Delta, but we have performance measures for water supply reliability, reduced risk, as well as the Delta as an evolving place. So right now there are 32 performance measures, and the ecosystem chapter amendment is expected to add a few more. So while we are at the starting line, Cliff, Tracy, and Caitlin will then share their experience and lessons learned from systems that already got started.
Cliff, welcome back.
Yes.
Good to see you.
I was going to say that this is like deja vu all over again, isn't it? Anyway, it's very nice to be back, and I enjoy the opportunity to talk about a couple examples where performance measures have been developed, implemented, analyzed, synthesized, and decisions made. And there are a couple examples that I personally have had close proximity to the work, and so hopefully you'll find it to be of interest in giving you a sense of examples where they've gone sort of full circle on the adaptive management process, where they did the planning, they implemented, they made the measurements, they learned from those measurements, and some significant decisions then got made. So the two that I'm going to highlight for you, and I have three slides each, so I'll try to go through these briefly and succinctly. The first one is the Kissimmee River Restoration Project in South Florida. The four pictures there are to basically provide you a kind of pictorial overview of what has gone on in this part of South Florida. My engagement in this started in 1992 when I was approached to be on an external advisory panel to advise them on the development of their performance measures. They called them expectations. The Kissimmee River is a large, low-gradient, meandering river that is the major tributary to Lake Okeechobee. So part of that riverine system to lake to Everglades, part of the South Florida ecosystem. The river itself, back in the 50s, looked like that picture on the upper right. It was a sinuous, low-gradient, highly connected to its floodplain river of about 160 kilometers in length with huge areas of fringing wetlands. Some federal money was made available in the 60s to basically do what was basically advertised as flood control on the Kissimmee River. Over a 9-year period, they turned the 160-kilometer river into a 100-kilometer canal. And the picture on the lower left will sort of show you what that canal then looked like after its construction. The byproduct, however, of this flood control effort was some pretty substantive degradation of some of the ecosystem values of the wetlands and river. To give you an example, 95% of the wading birds were lost. 90% of the overwintering duck population was lost. A trophy bass fishery was lost. So there was a strong public interest in trying to undo some of the changes that had occurred that were undesirable. And so process went on of discussing what could be done, planning what could be done, doing some pilot projects to see whether or not it was feasible. And ultimately, the decision was to go forward with restoring about two-thirds of the river system. The group that I was involved with was then charged with coming up with the performance measures that would be used to evaluate whether these restoration activities actually worked. It's a three-phase restoration project. One and two are done. I believe three is ongoing. They're fairly extensive. It's something like 25,000 acres of wetland, 100 kilometers of stream. And so the process of developing the performance measures went on for about 4 years. They were adopted. They were begun to making measurements. They made measurements for 3 years before the restoration started, so they established a pretty strong baseline in the altered system. And then they began the process of the restoration, and they then followed through on these performance measures. The performance measures really were the outgrowth of some fairly straightforward and, I think, simple but useful conceptual models that were developed about the system. So the basic premise behind the restoration is that if we could get the geomorphology back to where it was more connected between the river and the wetlands, and if we could get the hydrologic system back where the higher flows occur during the time of year that historically had higher flows, and low flows would occur when historically the low flows were good. The way they were operating the canal basically completely reversed that, and so that was one of the problems. So the development of this then, this restoration was designed to try to deal with these two major changes on the left-hand side of the diagram. Some of the things then that would be affected was the flow of the riverine systems. The substrate, which because it had become more like a canal or more like a slow-moving water body, was just full of muck, literally producing major oxygen fluctuations in the overlying water column. And there was very little connectivity between the historic wetlands and the current river. That was taken care of with the first phase of the restoration, and then what were their performance measures? Well, the performance measures were designed to focus on the things that the public were most interested in. And the public were most interested in the bird communities, they were very interested in the fish communities, and they were very interested in the plants and the wetland plant communities. So those were the areas where a lot of the effort was then focused. We started out a process, and I think this is pretty typical of when these processes are developed for performance measures. Hundreds, literally hundreds of performance measures were suggested by the public, by scientists, by agency folks. These were ultimately coalesced down into about 60 measurements that were actually then implemented. As I said, they were implemented starting in 1997. The restoration then started in 2000, 2001. And they have been followed now through, you know, basically two decades of effort to follow then how this process worked. The performance measures are quite effectively reported out both to the decision makers and to the public. So there's been strong long-term public support for this effort. And also the performance measures were very useful in, after having done phase one, to help design and modify the phase two, and then, you know, has then also been moved into the phase three. The little diagram on the lower right there is basically an executive summary. Martina has the summary. I've told a lot of people about it, but it's a good overview of how they did it, what they've done, and how they've used that information for decision making. The second one that I wanted to just briefly talk about is the Healthy Waterways Initiative in Southeast Queensland. Back in 2007, I had a sabbatical available to me, and I had heard about the work that was going on in this part of Southeast Queensland, and I was extremely impressed with how effectively they had designed a monitoring program to help with the decision-making as to how to invest scarce resources in trying to make some positive changes, both in Moreton Bay, which is kind of an iconic bay in Australia, and in the catchments that drain into Moreton Bay. There are 15 major catchments that flow into Moreton Bay. It's in an area, large area, you know, 5.5 million acre area. Interesting, complex governmental systems there. There are regional governments, there are watershed governments, there are the Queensland government, and there's the federal government. So there's about 40 different entities that actually came together to actually generate the resources to actually pay for this restoration, or pay for the evaluation program to help make decisions on what kinds of restoration would be done. And so the evaluation of the condition of the bay, Moreton Bay, began in 1998. It became very clear early on that the bay was receiving a lot of suspended sediment from some of the catchments. Actually, turns out it was 4 of the 15 catchments were the major contributors, and they were also getting a lot of nutrients into the bay. And those were causing some of the problems with the bay, which was decreasing clarity of the water, harmful algal blooms, collapse of some of the major food webs that involve some of the fish and shellfish that were important to them. So similar things that you hear about here. And so the ecosystem health monitoring program that they put in place is an interesting one in that they take 5 areas of needed information, carry out these surveys, and then actually generate information that they communicate quite effectively to the public and to the local governments. It's also interesting that they also report out a report card. They say, your catchment gets an A, your catchment gets a B, your catchment gets a D. And they also do status and trends analysis on these. Is your system improving? Well, it was interesting. They implemented this in 2002. Some of you may realize that in 2002, Australia was in the second year of what became the millennial drought, basically a decade of very low precipitation throughout Australia. This area, Brisbane, actually had the drought broken in 2008, but the indicators that they were using, which involved fish, it involved invertebrates, it involved the physical and chemical attributes of the system, it involved ecosystem processes, and it involved the nutrients, it didn't do too terribly well for the first 6 or 7 years they made these measurements. The point I want to make here is that they did, however, sustain these measurements. They reported them out. They discussed, you know, what the likely changes would be if good precipitation years return. And that is ultimately what did happen. But I just am basically saying this is you have to sustain your effort through the bad times, because the bad times are going to occur. We're a highly variable climate here in California. You're not always going to get good indicator reports every year. And so the long-term perspective is important. And then finally, just the last thing I'll briefly say is this is one of the reasons I really liked this program is the two things. One is they really present the science in a way that the public engages with it, and they have a very good outreach program that starts at the K through 12 and goes through all levels of interaction with the public. And in addition, they have taken the information from this, and they've used this to generate the kind of public support for the $8 million per year monitoring program that this effort requires, with a consortium of different government entities all contributing to the monetary and the communicative part of these processes. So these are two examples. I'll turn it over to Tracy, who I think is going to give you another one from here, from the west coast of the United States. But these are my sort of two go-to examples of where performance measures have been used well.
Thanks, Cliff. Tracy, welcome.
Thank you, Randy, and thanks to the other council members. Can I have the clicker there, Cliff? So I'm going to talk about Puget Sound, maybe. Or are you going to look at me on the screen? Yeah, I do too. For your sake, I really hope you can. Well, here we go. Okay, so in 2008, when I was still a Fed with NOAA Fisheries, I was asked to oversee a project to develop a series of environmental indicators for Puget Sound. I'm just showing this slide to show that it was Sandy O'Neill, the lead author, and then myself were the two main people doing this for a couple of years with a regional consortium. But I'm going to go through some of the process here, but we've had to retrench and come back to these indicators and reanalyze them and rethink the process by which we derive them. And I want to give you some lessons maybe from that you can hopefully avoid that were sometimes painful lessons for us. And also I wanted to say we're talking now, this last report is about evolving the portfolio of indicators, and we're calling this the Indicator Evolution Project. So we have our own IEP up in Puget Sound. So I get confused. So if I ever get confused and we're talking about IEP down here, don't hold it against me. And again, I'm calling these indicators. You folks are calling them performance measures. There's a number of different semantics can be a killer in this area. People can get really wrapped around the axle. Go with the semantics you've got. Go with what you're enabling legislation. In our case, we were, by the laws that started the Puget Sound Partnership, we were required to identify environmental indicators measuring the health of Puget Sound. So we use the term indicators. Other people use performance measures. Other people use other semantics. But don't let yourselves get too wrapped up in that. So that process that we started in 2008 led to an adoption of what they called the vital signs in 2010 and 11 by the Leadership Council as surrogates of the status of the ecosystem. I also want to point out Bill Ruckelshaus was the chair of our Leadership Council at that point. He wanted three indicators. He didn't want any more than that. He wanted something really simple. I'll come back to this wheel, the vital signs wheel, but we ended up with 2021. And then part of our enabling legislation was once we developed these indicators, we're required to have the Washington State Academy of Sciences review the process by which we selected them, see if it's scientifically valid, and look at the outputs of our indicator evaluation to see whether or not, in fact, it was defensible. That's something I would say maybe you don't want to put that in your legislations. I'm a little facetious, but not terribly. So the Academy of Sciences report came out in 2012, and they had four issues where they were concerned. I'm not going to go through all four of these. Most of them were, we need more of this, we haven't thought about this enough, things you can go back and fix. But the second one, in bold, the evaluation of indicators was fatally flawed because the criteria did not emphasize scientific validity. Now, if you're required to develop indicators and you're required to have them evaluated by your state academy of sciences and they say what you've come up with is fatally flawed, that's a bit of an issue. So we have had to go back for several years now and look at what we came up with and try to figure out how to fix it so it can pass the Academy of Sciences muster. The reason it's fatally flawed, though, is because we were taking time, as Cliff said, for like Moreton Bay, there are hundreds of indicators out there. Hundreds of people are making measurements. You have to figure out which ones you can use, which ones are aspirational, which ones are real. There's a whole criteria that you go through to evaluate indicators and then come up with what are usable indicators, which is what we spent the better part of 2 years doing. And then the partnership at this point was getting a little frustrated because the scientists were taking a lot of time and we were having a lot of meetings and making a lot of conceptual models. And they said, we really need to have these indicators faster. Thank you very much for your evaluation of what are suitable indicators. We now are going to go into a room with a bunch of scientists and a bunch of managers and some policymakers, and we're going to choose the indicators. And that's what they did. And they got that done in a month, and it would have taken us, if we did the regional collaboration that we had been, it would have taken us another year. But they needed the indicators for a number of reasons, not the least of which was to be able to respond to the legislature. So that's the part where, when those final selections of indicators were made, some indicators got chosen that were not scientifically valid. And so that's where the Academy of Sciences came back and said, this doesn't pass muster. An example of one of those would be one of the indicators we chose was the number of orca whales in the resident killer whale pods. A really great indicator for communicating to the public, but it has almost no relevance to our management actions in the short term. It's not going to work. It's not a good indicator if you're trying to report out. But the public definitely wants to know. So that's the type of an indicator that sometimes are chosen for social or political reasons, but not technical reasons. And that came back to us and saying that we were fatally flawed. So we went back to our framework for how we chose and evaluated the indicators. Don't read all the numbers on here. The point is it's a simple decision tree. You have a certain criterion. You say, yes, this indicator meets it, or no, it doesn't. If it gets kicked off to the right. You go to the next step. Yes, does it meet it, or no, does it get kicked off to the right? As you go down, the last couple of steps, if it's no, it's always not acceptable as an indicator. But now if you get down to the third and fourth steps, you're getting some indicators that have passed a certain amount of review and have some utility, and then you're maybe saying, this indicator currently is not usable, but with a little extra work, we could make it usable. But in the end, you come up with, at the bottom, your good candidate indicators. And that's the sort of process that most systems go through, and there's frameworks that are published, and there's always new frameworks and new ways to evaluate these indicators. But basically, we have been going through this process for quite some time in Puget Sound. So again, we came back to the vital signs. This is a little more blow up. You can see, I wanted to point out from about 12 o'clock to 4 o'clock on this figure, those are all indicators of human health and attributes. So both human health directly, as well as the human quality of life or human well-being. We've really tried to emphasize that in Puget Sound. I think most systems are realizing that. And that's always, if any of our indicators have some weakness currently, I would say it's probably the quality of life, because we just, as we're finding out down in the Delta, we just don't have the social science framework or infrastructure to actually dig into some of these things. But so here we've still got, these are the 20 vital signs that were chosen originally by the Leadership Council. They're remaining. We're doing some tweaking. But what we've done as part of our review and this more thorough evaluation of the indicators is, we're saying, and this is in our report that we just put out, there are two indicator portfolios that we're proposing. One is the vital signs. Those are what you use to, it's fairly coarse-grained. It's a small, hopefully small number of indicators. It's not Bill Ruckelshaus's three indicators, but it's manageable. But those are what we use to inform the public and policymakers about the state of the ecosystem. That's how we report out. Every 2 years, we do a state of the sound, and we go on all these indicators and say, is it going the right way? Yes or no. And orca whales are not going the right way, by the way. But then what we're recommending is that we have to have assessment indicators. And again, Cliff talked about having 60, coalescing them down to 25. What we're saying is, you, especially in a complex system like Puget Sound and in the Delta, we don't know. I mean, in the Kissimmee River, if we de-channelize the river, that's going to take care of a huge part of our issues. We don't know the main big issues in Puget Sound. I don't think we know them for sure in the Delta. We know some of them. I know when we first started on the ISB, the first question we got was, what's the one big stressor we need to deal with? And we said, that's not a good question to ask us. But we're it was you and Phil and basically everybody else. So what we're saying is, you have to have these assessment indicators that underlie the management decisions you're making about the system. It's a larger set of metrics, and it both reflects your understanding of the system, and to some extent, it's going to enhance your understanding of the system. It's going to be messy, but it's what's going to be used by the scientists and the managers to actually manage the system, to develop your strategies and to monitor the responses and to keep track of things. We're going to report out to the public on the vital signs. The other stuff is all certainly public information. But our recommendation is it's going to take a sort of a two-tiered set of assessments to be able to manage a system where you have multiple stressors and you don't know how all things interact. The unfortunate part of this is this takes a long time. It's very complicated. It's not what your legislature and your politicians are going to want to hear, but it reflects the reality of if you want to understand and manage a system where there's a lot of things in play, you have to do this, in my view. But with that, I'll stop and pass it over to Caitlin.
Welcome, Caitlin.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Caitlin Sweeney, again, the director of the Estuary Partnership. You may recall that I was here before you. I think it was September of last year, and I was speaking about the partnership and also our estuary blueprint. So just as a reminder, because I'm going to start from there, the blueprint is our collaborative vision for the future of the estuary. It lays out long-term goals, where we want to be in 2050, and then essentially a five-year action plan, a strategy of actions that we can undertake to help move us towards those goals. So I think I actually showed this figure, too, in September, and it looks very much like your own adaptive management figure. They all are relatively similar. And I spoke briefly about the need to track our progress in implementing the blueprint, or here it's called the CCMP, the old name, Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan. You see why we rebranded it as the Estuary Blueprint. Much easier to say. But, of course, tracking our progress is essential and a key component of our adaptive management strategy. So, like the Delta Plan performance measures, we recognize that we can and we should track progress both in terms of our programmatic outputs and our environmental outcomes. So I'm going to first talk about the easy one, of course, which is the programmatic outputs. So each of the actions in the Estuary Blueprint, you may recall seeing this, are structured the exact same way. They all have a set of tasks and milestones. So there's a milestone for each task, essentially by X date, do Y. So this lends itself very easily to tracking progress in terms of did we meet the milestones at the task level. So on our website, it's a little tough to see, but on our website you can click on any action. It'll bring up a bar graph of the tasks within that action, and you can see percent completion of each task within an action. And the bar graphs are linked to a spreadsheet. It's linked live, which we update quarterly. So the information that's out there to the public and to our partners is very up-to-date in terms of our progress in meeting our milestones. And then we can package that in various ways. We can package it, for example, on the right, you see the pie chart. This is something we provide to our implementation committee every quarter that just shows how many tasks we have started, not started, completed, and we can roll that up to the action level as well. Very simple, very easy to do, and it was easy to do because we built in those milestones when we were developing our blueprint and didn't think about it afterwards. So, we laid the groundwork for this kind of reporting. But when we move from programmatic outputs to environmental outcomes, of course, just as important, but much harder to do. In our case, we have the separate document. We all have the State of the Estuary report that we update periodically that provides an assessment of the health of the estuary based on a suite of indicators because we had to call it that because we are an estuary partnership. And in our case, the data that we have for the indicators, they are plotted against a benchmark or maybe two benchmarks, and the benchmarks are based on a historical data set, or if a historical data set doesn't exist, a vetted, agreed-upon policy goal. So that allows us to assess the status of each indicator relative to the benchmark as fair, poor, good, fair, poor, right? So it allows us to make some overall conclusions about the Bay and Delta, about the status of the health, and then which then can form the basis of our management response, which would be our estuary blueprint. So if the blueprint is the management response to what science tells us, I'll get into this box in a minute, then we should be able to compare progress, by that I mean the status of outputs, to change, the status of our outcomes. But of course, that relationship isn't always linear, and it's not always directly causal enough to really compare. So this is a table from the estuary blueprint, which just simply lists all of the indicators in the state of the estuary report and how they are linked to the blueprint's goals, objectives, and actions. And you can see just by looking at how many lines and numbers there are that it's not a one-to-one relationship mostly. Instead, you know, we made a choice not to track individual outcomes for each milestone, but to allow for a combination of management responses to meet an environmental challenge, to allow for a little bit of that messiness. And in some cases, of course, the linkages are not that clear and not that linear, not that easy. So again, the data that are in the suite of indicators that are in our State of the Estuary report are based on what we are already tracking, what we have data for, and where we can produce a benchmark. So we have to have a historical data set or, again, an agreed-upon policy goal. So we have, you know, a great set of data, but it's limited. And it's particularly limited for the entire system, for the entire estuary. We have some data sets that are only Bay, some that are only Delta. So we're working on improving that, but we're limited by what we have available so far. So in some cases, our outputs or our milestones call for more science, and that will feed back into our State of the Estuary report. So essentially, we do the best we can, right? We assess the status of our outputs. We assess the status of the trends of the indicators, and we compare these over time. And we hope that we're making some, you know, informed connections between these two things. And we compare it over a 4 to 6 year time cycle that allows enough time for the environment to respond to our management actions, enough time for us to be able to really track change in the environment. But it's messy. You said it's messy. I have messy in my notes too. It's messy. Performance measures are messy, yes. Does it drive scientists and managers alike crazy? Absolutely. Are there areas we can improve? Most certainly. Every time we update our estuary blueprint or update our State of the Estuary report, and they are on these cycles, we have an opportunity to make those linkages cleaner and clearer and fill the gaps. But in the meantime, you know, is it still worth it? Absolutely, absolutely. Because there are many benefits, we think, to performance measures that go beyond really being dependent on those links between the outputs and outcomes being squeaky clean and easily quantifiable, right? So we need to try. We need to always be in pursuit of that adaptive management strategy where we're planning and implementing and measuring and assessing and reporting and planning and implementing, right? And we need to quantify the results in any and all ways that we can because we need to be accountable. We need to be accountable to ourselves. We need to be accountable to our partners. We need to be accountable to the public who wants to know how we're spending their dollars. So any way that we can produce something to show progress is extremely useful. And it turns out that talking about results, talking about progress, is a great outreach opportunity. It's a great engagement opportunity for us. So we ourselves, we share our results in a variety of ways. You know, we package it in charts and graphs for those people that really need charts and graphs. We also do, you know, much more human-focused stories about our successes and our partners' successes. We do videos and sound bites. We do in-depth reporting in magazines. So we're able to talk about progress in a variety of ways to a variety of people because we know how important engagement is. And that we know that the results of engagement are quantifiable, if we could figure out what the performance measure for that would be. But tongue-in-cheek a little bit. But it's always, you know, it's a circular process, and we absolutely need to keep trying, and it's absolutely worth it. Thank you.
So it's good to hear from experts who have been on the front lines of this. I had a front row seat watching Cliff lead our team in developing performance measures, and I have a good sense as to how difficult and time-consuming this is. So thank all three of you for sharing with you your own experiences. Any questions of the panelists? Susan.
This is for any panel member. I'm curious, when you're engaging with the public and they're giving you their thoughts on performance measures that would be useful, does anyone ask those who are participating if they're expecting some day or time when the system is quote-unquote healthy? And it's, you know, I'm just trying to imagine how would you answer that question of how do we know when we're completely healthy and we can just sort of stop measuring so much?
So a little bit tongue-in-cheek, we were told that by Christine Gregoire. She told us when the partnership was created, you will be done by 2020. Mm-hmm. It will be restored to health. We all use health, and I won't go on too long, we all use health as a indicator of sort of our subjective assessment of what we want the system to look like, but it's not really quantifiable. And that's in the restoration science and restoration ecology, that's always an issue of what people really think they mean by what is restored, what is healthy. That's a social construct. I don't think it's a technical construct, is my view. So I don't answer that question if I get it.
I would only add that I usually add to that response something about the system's always changing. We're always responding to new threats. We're always responding to, as the system is evolving, with climate change, for example. So we don't have a point that we're going to get to and call it done. We're always going to be responding to the system and trying to increase the health. So we all have our non-answers to that question.
I'll add another non-answer, but the one thing that I did find that the performance measures did succeed in doing, particularly in Australia, is it did help them make decisions on how to take limited resources and invest them for continued improvement in the system. And I'll provide two examples. The nutrient loading into the bay that was causing a lot of the serious problems were pretty much then tracked to three wastewater treatment plants that needed upgrading. And so that became number one priority. The second one was the sediment. Where was it coming from? Was it coming from the uplands? Was it coming from agriculture? Or was it coming from some of the arroyo formation that was occurring in the catchment? Turned out the majority of the sediment was coming from the riparian areas along the channels. And so investing on restoration that targeted that specific part of the ecosystem was where they put their dollars. I don't think they're ever going to say that this system is healthy and we're going to stop making the measurements because, as Caitlin, I think, said very well, systems are not static. They're always changing. But at least making decisions as to what areas need more attention is one way that these performance measures help us make those decisions.
So how long do you give a performance measure an opportunity to be addressed? And at what point does the changing baselines or ineffective inputs or technology trigger the need to update or change a performance measure?
I am closest to the mic. That's an excellent question, and one that we have to ask ourselves. I think it's important to set out a regular update for your performance measures or your document, whatever that is. It could be 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, but at least it gives you an opportunity to set aside the time and resources to reevaluate and look at that very question. What of these performance measures are still relevant? Where are the gaps? What are we missing? What is no longer relevant or never was relevant?
And I'll concur that this is an extremely difficult question to give you a very good answer to. The one thing that I would point out is that the one thing you don't want to get in the business of doing is developing performance measures, implementing them, and then suddenly wholesale changing the vast majority of them. You need consistency. You need to give the measures a chance to show you whether they're actually showing you what you want to know about the system. There may be times that you'll edit some out or you'll adjust them accordingly, but don't get into the business of making major changes in your performance measures in a short time period, because that's probably not wise.
And part of your evaluation of your performance measures really should include your best assessment of what's the time frame in which it will respond. So once you have that assessment of the time frame, that will inform you as to what time period you should maybe go back and reevaluate. Orca whales are a very long time frame, obviously. So you need to, but then, of course, you need to say, it's hard to say every 4 to 6 years we'll look at all of them unless you know they all respond in that time frame. So that's part of the, you should do that due diligence to estimate what the time frame is for response before you reevaluate, because otherwise you go back way too soon.
Mr. Chair.
Skip and then Ken.
Thank you. And to your comment, Tracy, about politicians, and I'm one of these politicians and policymakers, and even though I don't understand a lot of the science, it helps me understand the processes and the thoughts that go in to making recommendations and helping this policymaker understand what is needed. And understanding is also resources necessary to implement some of these processes. So in that regard, it's very helpful to me. I appreciate it.
I mean, your pressures are very real. So, I think it's the responsibility of the technical community as well as the policy folks to try to have these sorts of discussions so they can better understand the drivers that each of these groups are facing. That's why, in some regards, a lot of our scientists said we have to come up with better answers faster for the policy folks. Now we're having to go back and revisit it, but we knew it at the time. We knew that what we were doing was going to be problematic, but we needed that answer for folks like you. So,
Tracy, the orcas were not a good indicator, you mentioned, but they're declining. So it was one of these examples of it wasn't a good indicator because there was nothing you can do about it, or there was extraneous, you know, impacts on them that really didn't reflect the health of the sound? Is that
so? They are a good indicator for communication and for talking to the public. Excellent for that. But we were supposed to come up with environmental indicators that were showing how the sound was responding to our management. The problem with orcas is we think we know the three big factors. We know three factors. We're not sure which is the biggest. We're pretty sure now it's salmon. Restoring the salmon is going to take us a couple of decades. The time frame for orca recovery is going to be half a century. So it's not a good indicator if you're talking about how well you're managing the system, especially when the governor told you to be done by 2020. So they are a good indicator of the overall health of the system because so many things feed into the orca populations, but they're not responsive to management in a time frame that's very useful for ecosystem recovery.
No, that's helpful. And there's a question that staff put into the staff report that I just have to ask because it's really a hard one to answer.
Actually, you have to ask it because staff put it in there.
Yes, and I've heard that, hey, we put questions in there and you guys don't ask them. What are management responses to performance assessments where linkages between system conditions and specific actions are not well understood, nonlinear, or include high uncertainty? So the way I looked at it is, well, what do you do when you don't know what to do? Anybody could answer that.
Go ahead. You're local. You can come back.
I'm trying to figure out where to start. I have these interesting discussions, these sort of chicken and egg discussions about performance measures and your management response, right? Do you develop your management actions and then develop performance measures to measure whether or not your management actions resulted in anything, or do you do an assessment of the health and then develop management responses in response to that? And then you're in this cyclical loop. It's a fascinating, for some of us, debate. And so I bring that up because we jumped in with a report that laid it out already, and then we had a management response. But some of the things we wanted to do in our management response didn't equate very well to the performance measures. So that's why we ended up sort of doing the best we can. I'm going to go back to it's messy and doing the best you can by accepting that there are management actions that you may be able to track or you may not be able to track, but there are a suite of environmental indicators that you would have to look at to see if there was any sort of response. So the more you can bunch things together in some cases, the more informed your decisions will be as you go forward. It won't be clean, but you'll be able to look at cubism. You need to look at it from all angles, all the angles that you have, because it isn't always linear, and it's not a clean system.
And that happens a lot in terms of we don't know what to do, so what are we going to do about it? What I fall back on almost always is if we aren't sure how the system's going to respond to our different management actions in terms of the ecosystem outcomes, as we were talking about from the Delta perspective, fall back on what you think the major pressures are on the system. What are the big stresses? How do you mitigate those stresses? How do you reduce those stresses? So if you don't know that, you should spend some time trying to figure out what your major stressors are and then see if those respond to your management actions. And with the somewhat of an assumption, and maybe it's a hope, that the ecosystem will respond to those reductions in pressure if we understand the system well enough. But there's many times when we don't know what to do, so we should fall back on what we think the major stresses are in the system and try to reduce those. That's what I usually advise. It doesn't mean people listen to us, but that's what I think. And, I mean, your idea with sediment and nutrients is exactly that. So.
And I'll just add one example from the Kissimmee River Restoration Project, and that was, yes, there was a high degree of uncertainty as to how the system would respond to the removal of the channelization. One of the things that they could do initially was to set up a pilot project of small scale. But what they basically did is they pushed water back onto the floodplain that had been dewatered for about four decades to see whether or not some of the key things would happen. And they had then a suite of things that they measured for 3 years. And they gave them enough confidence to at least say that, okay, we think that we should go the next step, which was the larger scale restoration. So incrementalism sometimes helps.
So you guys all talked about two different sort of uses of performance measures directly to management actions and then more broadly for public education. Could you talk more about how those fit together? Is it just a subset of some of them that could be used? Or how do you choose the ones that are more useful and that are meaningful for public education? Is there a way to roll them all up so that you can combine them? Or is it just... are there different indicators or different measures that are used for outreach rather than management?
Go
ahead. You go first.
That's when I saw these lists of questions, the first thing I said was, these are really hard questions. you want to ask me these in the public, huh? That is a really good question. The issue of reporting to the public versus the understanding the system and how it's responding to management is a difficult one. We generally are, up in Puget Sound, we're tending to go towards what we're calling sort of lagging indicators and leading indicators that are basically saying, and I don't want to get into the technical weeds on it, but there's ways to communicate with each of those. And then there's tracking indicators, and then there's public reporting indicators. And we're still grappling with that as to how to take something even like the vital signs, which is 21 indicators, how to report that to the public in a way that doesn't glaze over everybody's eyes. It is really hard. And you have to, I think, know your public, and you have to look at your indicators and decide. And I think from what I'm understanding of what Caitlin's talking about, they've done a really good job of saying, here are the indicators that we know resonate with the public. Here's how we're going to report on them, and here's how we're going to engage the public with our data.
I guess the only thing I would add to that is that communications is a multifaceted approach. There's not just one thing that you can do. And with the way that communication is changing and the social media that we're engaged with in our daily lives, you also need to bring that into the communication portfolio.
And I would add that, yeah, it helps to have multiple levels that the public can dig into, or starting from the bottom, having an indicator that is very scientifically vetted, but that over, as you move forward, you can actually at some point just say good, fair, poor, and have that sort of report card approach, which is a great communication tool, but only works if you've got really solid science behind that and can back it up. And it's very hard to get to that good fair pour. Scientists don't like to do that. It's very difficult, but it's an excellent communication tool, and we get the public all the time asking, can you do one of those report cards? We want an ABC. But also, to your point, what's also interesting is we have the need to track indicators of stewardship, for example, which is much harder to track. And we can track, you know, how many members of the public are out there on a clean the beach day. Like, those kinds of indicators are also really, really useful, very important in helping us understand how well we are doing in engaging the public and increasing the stewardship of our public. And we struggle a lot with that series of indicators, truthfully.
Any other questions? Then, panelists, thank you very much. This has been very helpful, very useful. Martina, thank you for your leadership at the staff level and for organizing this panel. We're constantly seeking more input to do this better. So thank you all for your help. Is there any request for public comment on file item number 9? All right. Then we shall move to our final agenda item 10, a discussion of the 2018 priorities at the midpoint.
Great. Good afternoon.
Jessica Law, our Chief Deputy Executive Director, will guide us through this topic.
All right. Good afternoon, Council members. I know everyone's hungry, so I'll go through this pretty quickly. But I wanted to provide you with a mid-year update on staff priorities. It's sort of amazing to me that we're at the midpoint year. January doesn't seem like it was that far off. But in your binders, you all have a staff report. There's a table in there that tracks how we're doing on all of our priorities. But I just wanted to give you some highlights from my perspective of where we're really making a ton of progress. So overall, I think we've made progress on all of the priorities that are listed in here. There are two that we're starting to initiate at the end of the year, and I can talk a little bit more about those. But overall, so one, I wanted to highlight sort of the highest priority items that are on this list that are almost near completion or we've made really significant progress on. So I think the top of that list is the adoption of the CSO D-List and Performance Measures Amendment that happened in March. That was really a super high priority for this year and certainly had been developed over the course of several years. We are finalizing the OAL Administrative Office of Law process, and that should be complete by the end of the year. Also, in terms of major accomplishments so far, we are moving forward and working on the Delta Science Plan, and that it looks like it'll be completed by the end of the year. It'll be out for public review later this summer, including review by the Independent Science Board. The Bay Delta Science Conference is coming up in September. That's always a major effort on our part to plan, and we're really looking forward to that. Hopefully some of you can attend. DPIC meeting number 9 occurred in April. We've got one more in November for this year. There's always a lot of work that goes into that, and I think the last one was incredibly successful, and we're looking forward to the November meeting. The work that we've been doing with the interagency, the IMIT, I can never... I always forget what the acronym stands for, but we've been doing a tremendous amount of work with the Eco Restore program and restoration community at large, working on an adaptive management framework for restoration, and that work will continue and mostly be completed by the end of the year. And then another priority that's on this list that I wanted to highlight as an accomplishment is identify and pursue funding for critical science. This year, through the budget process, we were able to secure an additional $2 million for critical science funding, which is really exceptional. We're working on a spending plan for that for next year that will likely include a competitive solicitation process. And hopefully there will be some federal agency participation in that also. So those are some of the main highlights. Also, there's several projects that have been initiated this year, and that was really the main goal, which was to get them started. So that's the climate vulnerability assessment, reporting on the performance measures output outcome. So you just heard the whole panel presentation on that. We'll have some more information about that by the end of the year. And then also the integrated modeling RFP that John had talked about during his presentation. And, of course, the ecosystem amendment, we actually started that in 2017, and the work on that is continuing and will continue a bit into next year also. But we're doing a tremendous amount of work on that this year. And then finally, I just wanted to highlight the last two items that are on the list, developing a 5-year strategic and operations plan and developing a communications and public participation plan. These are two items that staff is starting to work on, but we think we're really going to kick off sort of later in this year and probably will go into next year. So those are two things that we haven't fully engaged in yet at this midpoint. But finally, in terms, it's not on this list, but I really wanted to highlight what I think is one of the biggest accomplishments so far this year, which is hiring staff. So we've hired 10 new staff, including a whole new meeting services team. So Eric, Brandon, and Lita are new faces at council meetings, but we've hired 10 new staff, and we've promoted 3 new staff, and of course we have a new council member. So we have a really great team right now that's helping us accomplish the work that we've completed so far and is going to help us get through the rest of the year. So with that, I didn't list any questions in the staff report, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, that because you would be the one answering the questions,
yeah.
It's reasonable that you wouldn't put any hard questions in the staff report.
I just had a comment, but not a question, that as a new council member, I really appreciate what you do in the orientation that I had and all the information that I get, because I understand that I'm kind of behind and I'm trying to catch up, and they've been very helpful. Thank you.
That's good. Questions or comments of Jessica? Well, good midterm review, and we'll look forward to an equally healthy next 6 months. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Any requests for public comment on file item number 10? All right. So, we are now down to file item number 11, public comment. If Tim O'Loughlin were here, I would call him up, but he is not. John, I think for your benefit, he handed out a 2017 ocean salmon fisheries handout, and I think he was highlighting a concern about the Pacific Fishery Management Council's preseason predictions, which some decisions are based on, and the concerns about the accuracy of those. So maybe there's an opportunity to fold this topic into a lead scientist report at some time. So with that, thank you all for coming. This meeting is adjourned.